One company that does business with the government is Ernst & Young, and we have talked on a number of times on this program about project management and making sure that projects either stay on the rails or get back on the rails if they go off them fairly quickly. David Tomei is Executive Director of Assurance and Advisory Business Services for Ernst & Young, and Bill Colbert is a partner in the Assurance and Advisory Businesses Service a practice for Ernst & Young, both gentlemen in the studio with me today, and welcome to the program. Thanks for being on today.
Thank you, Francis.
Yeah, thank you, Francis.
Let's kind of get a snapshot. We'll start with you, Bill. Where do we stand today when it comes to project management in the government, in your view?
Well, I think, you know, project management is something that obviously has been very prevalent for forever in the federal government, and focusing on doing initiatives and doing them well and managing them effectively. And I think where we are today is we clearly have those projects which are large and ambitious in scope and highly complex in terms of the constituencies involved, and in many cases the number of third-party providers providing support to those projects. But today what we also have is a focus on transparency and accountability, which you know, we're seeing in a number of different ways. Management watch lists, for example, are ways where we're getting visibility into these projects and programs and whether they do well or they don't do well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a big factor that's impacting the steps that we take in managing the projects, and more importantly, that reporting out of where we are. And also then focuses on what we need to do from a predictive analysis perspective and looking at how the projects are going to end up and how ultimately they can be successful.
Mm-hmm. The reason I wanted to start there, Dave, is because we hear and report on, of course, the projects that go badly.
Right.
Everybody wants to talk about the ones that are really terrible and or that have major deficiencies. And so I wonder if that's a fair snapshot of what we're seeing, or whether there are a whole lot of others that kind of fly under the radar screen that maybe we don't hear about because they're not egregious, but still are struggling because of the complexity or whatever.
Yeah. Well, Francis, excellent point, because what you find is that it's just that situation where there is a high degree, it's actually a high percentage of programs that are challenged.
Mm-hmm.
And there are cases where they appear in disputes, and quite often those you don't hear about. But the ones that are challenging represent a significant waste. And when you talk about the waste of both, you know, dollars for the project, but also the increase in time,
mm-hmm.
that equates to is reducing benefits. And so those types of programs are below the radar screen. They are very important. But the other thing is that you can predict those. You can understand early stages as to what goes wrong or what can be wrong, what the challenge points will be,
mm-hmm.
and develop those correlations.
What kind of metrics do you use to do that, though? Because if you look at a synopsis of how something is supposed to go, where do you see the trouble signs, and how is it that you, not you personally, but your company, sees the trouble signs that maybe the agency that you're working with doesn't see them, or that how does that work?
Yeah, well, one of the things that we do is what we find quite often is that programs and the overall project sponsors fail to take into account the unique factors of complexity for that program. And one of the things that we discovered at Ernst & Young through doing a lot of this analysis and also work from as expert witnesses on this are repeated patterns where people fail to look at and take into account these factors of complexity,
mm-hmm.
because there's an exponential relationship between complexity and risk. And so we can find out, you know, prior to the program actually being launched, you know, measuring the complexity and then saying how well have these factors of complexity been accounted for in the development of things such as the governance plan. I mean, how is the program going to be set up for governance?
Mm-hmm.
What types of processes and activities you have to make sure are accounted for that make this program unique? What types of controls? So you're not over-controlling, but yet not under-controlling, and making sure you have the proper tools in place.
Mm-hmm. Some things there I want to come back to, but I wanted to ask you first, Bill. You talked about transparency, and that's a buzzword that we are just hearing like crazy, like never before over the past 3 months or so. Have you noticed a difference in your clients in the government coming to you and saying, hey, wait a minute, we've been on this path before, and you've been helping us with X, Y, and Z, but we also have to add this component of transparency to it? Or is this something that, as you work with clients, you've kind of already been preparing for? How is that playing into the work that you're doing?
Well, I think certainly the sensitivity to it is much more heightened now. And, you know, any good project and program manager wants to do a very focused and fact-based assessment and reporting of how they're doing on their projects and how they're doing on their programs. What I think they're struggling with a bit more now is then how do I take that beyond just the stakeholder community that I touch on a week-to-week, month-to-month basis through my steering committee meetings and such, but more how do I think about how this will be reflected in the public eye, which is a completely different level of exposure, a completely different level of visibility that is certainly coming, and they know it's coming.
Yeah. You make a good point. I think that's the sensitivity term is a good term to describe it, because there has been, I think, an unfair implication that people that are working on projects, whether big contracts or whatever it is that's trying to be done in the government, I think there's been an unfair implication that they like not having anybody looking at them, right, as though there's some kind of ulterior motive. And there's certainly going to be bad apples in every bunch. But is it your experience that by and large that when something goes badly or not as well as it could, it's not malicious? It's just a fact that these programs are incredibly complex, much more, I think, complex and difficult to execute than what you might see in the private sector. Plus, you have the fact that you have 535 members of your board of directors on Capitol Hill that are looking for you to fail and not necessarily looking for you to succeed. Absolutely. Either one of you.
Well, excellent point. And this is one of the things that we see. It spans industry, particularly in the federal space, and that is, how do you properly set up your governance structure for accountability and get the proper visibility? And that becomes crucially important. So getting back to this aspect of complexity, the more complex programs dictate a higher degree of governance. So when you talk about governance, some people say, well, it's just the executive tier or the agency. Well, no. Mm-hmm. We want to make sure that, A, that each of those governance tiers are aligned, but then it's also both horizontally and vertically assessed, so that people need to understand what are the issues that should be raised when. What degree of empowerment do I have? And if I'm beyond my degree of empowerment for an issue that could impact the cost, the schedule, the quality, the benefits, you know, at what point can I resolve it? And when do I have to escalate it?
Yeah.
And so what we find consistently is the fact is that there's lack of clarity. So it's not malicious. What we see is that people are trying to do their best and trying to be, you know, conscious professionals.
Yes.
But it's the fact is that there's a faulty governance design.
That is, I think, being enhanced is not the right word because it's not a good situation, exacerbated by the number of younger employees who are coming in to the government who are used to a more collaborative environment, not seeing it, and so are struggling with exactly what you're saying, which is, when is it okay for me to say something, and when is it okay for me to actually do something about it myself, and if I do say something about it, what's the likelihood that action will be taken, to coin a phrase, above my pay grade?
Right, and it needs to be explicit. So when you talk about governance, some people say, well, here's the organization chart. Woefully inadequate.
Doesn't mean anything
Doesn't
anymore,
mean anything.
Does it?
No. Well, I mean, it shows, you know, kind of who's doing what, the role's responsibility, but it doesn't come alive of saying, what am I empowered to do? And so that you can make sure that you understand those issues you can resolve and you know who to go to. So it is collaborative. So when you look at it from a governance structure, it's almost a bit of an oxymoron. It's not a structure. It allows that collaboration, but allows teams to be more aligned with the specific objectives for this program. And what we see is that through some of the work we have is that a team member who worked on a particular project saying, you know, quality was really important, the next program, perhaps time was more important. If he's still making decisions saying, I want to make sure I'm operating at 5 or 6 sigma from a quality perspective.
Right.
That may be the wrong thing because that's not the criteria for success for the next program. So part of it is having that clear definition up front in your governance for defining success, defining your governance structure so that people understand how to work collaboratively, how to escalate to issues, and report effectively. And that also means at the top level, executives. What are the things that are coming to their table, to their agenda, and making sure that, that they are empowered and held accountable for the decisions that they have to make and the decisions that they don't make.
All right. Dave Tomei is Executive Director of the Assurance and Advisory Business Services for Ernst & Young, and his colleague Bill Colbert, who is a partner in the Assurances and Assurance Advisory Business Services practice at Ernst & Young, are my guests on In Depth with Francis Rose. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. This is Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guests are Dave Tomei and Bill Colbert from Ernst & Young, and we're talking about rapid project assessment, a way to make sure that your projects are being managed correctly and that they get on target from the very beginning, stay on target the whole way through to the end. This is another example of what I've talked about a number of times on the show, and that is I got to figure out a way to record the conversations that we have during the commercial breaks and put them up on the website, because we were having a terrific conversation about the role of the executive, the leader of each of these projects, and the fact that in many cases an executive can be extremely good at managing people, extremely good at matching task to the person who's supposed to execute that task, and yet not necessarily have managed something as complex, as expensive, all the elements that you add into it. And that, and so just the fact that somebody is a, air quotes, good leader doesn't necessarily ensure that that person is maybe the right fit for that project or is necessarily going to be successful just because they have some of the tools that go to a more broad definition of a good leader. Any thoughts about that?
Oh, yes, I think that in what we see on those programs that become challenged, or that actually end up failing, is that we see this correlation where the capabilities of the overall project and program manager, while in the past be successful and even perhaps even manage a program of success in the past, when you look at what the unique capabilities are and complexities for the program that they've just been assigned, you find out that they may not have the necessary prerequisite experience and skills to manage that level of program complexity. I mean, and a great example was I do some guest lecturing at Boston University, the graduate program, a project program management, and the class before was on mega success and showed a picture of an executive and his team, mega success for a program. The next project, I was representing him as an expert witness in a program that ended up being failed. Well, what went wrong? It's more than just the project manager as well.
Yeah.
And so part of it is saying there's something that's different. So it is vitally important to make sure that you match the project and program management capabilities and the leader with the complexity of the program going forward.
Bill, what are some of the ways that you do that? What are some of the ways that you look at, that you assess an executive's skill sets and say this is the right person, or this person may need some help in this area and here's how we do it?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things, Francis, that we've done in assembling what we call our predictive analysis tool for projects, is really looked at those factors, and it's not just time, cost and scope. It's many other factors than that. We've got about 120 different factors in the model that we look at every stage of the development of a program, including the governance, and looking at the express authority as well as the implicit authority that people have. And a lot of situations where we have strong executives who may or may not be experienced project managers, but can ultimately be very successful, is if you recognize that up front. Mm-hmm. And so what we've done is try to build a model that then helps us to look at those dimensions that we can then help the client to look at how do we supplement this individual ultimately to make them successful. Because it's something that you can lay out and you can look at if you really look at it objectively and really try to examine the underlying root aspects of what will make a successful project and program. And thing that I always like to tell folks about this that was a really unique experience that we had in being able to create this approach is we had a very large client who did the same project twice, extremely large program. The first time they did it very successfully, on time, on budget, on scope. The second time, virtually the same leadership team for that project did not get it done successfully, 30% over budget, 40% over time, and did not ultimately, the scope was the same, but ultimately wasn't successful. And they really wanted to learn, why is that as an organization? So we can do it better. So it was those kinds of experiences that went into this modeling, but then we can really structure a project or a program to help that project manager or program manager be successful.
That's an interesting case study, too, because it demonstrates that the people, not just the leader, but the people, I mean, from, if I understand right, exact same project, two times in a row,
right.
Same people.
Right.
At the same time. Two programs, same requirements, operating simultaneously.
And one worked and one didn't. That's fascinating. So, yeah. And I can hear executives that are listening to this show all over the government saying, ah, so they get it. These two guys get it, because this is the challenge
it's
that
reality,
the people.
Right?
Yeah. It's dealing with human beings instead of machines.
Right.
Excellent. We're going to continue this conversation in just a moment with Dave Tomei and Bill Colbert from Ernst & Young. We'll be back to wrap things up on In Depth with Francis Rose in just a moment. It's Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, talking to Bill Colbert and Dave Tomei from Ernst & Young about rapid project assessment. So now we've managed to identify, gentlemen, some of the issues that we run into, some of the reasons that we run into those issues. Now comes the part where we have a project that is in either getting off the ground and we want to make sure we keep it straight, or maybe is just freshly gone awry, mm-hmm. and we still have an opportunity to pull it back with minimal impact to the bottom line in the timeline. Talk about some of the techniques that you use to give information to the people who are running these projects to fix them. Bill, we'll start with you, because this is not really the place to say, well, I think this will probably work, or this is a philosophy that we've developed about project management. This is a time where somebody who comes to you says, I really need definitive explanations for how I can fix this issue.
Yeah, absolutely, Francis. We talked earlier about most of the times you look at a project on a very few number of dimensions.
Mm-hmm.
And what we do with this modeling is we look at it on 120 or more dimensions. And what that really allows you to do is kind of break down the pieces into much more discrete levels.
But what is the modeling based on?
So
what are the metrics when you do the modeling and you have these 120 elements? Where did you get the information to know that those are the right things to measure, and to know that when you measure them, you're measuring them correctly?
Right. Yeah, let me just jump in. Yeah. Part of that was, first of all, of having run successfully large complex programs, but more importantly is we began to develop and discover these patterns of when experienced teams representing well-known companies, when they get in trouble, and we have to opine as expert witnesses on this, we mm-hmm. began to see repeated patterns
mm-hmm.
and develop some correlations. And then we said, well, is this unique to this type of project program? And then we started going across different industries as expert witness, different types of projects and programs.
Mm-hmm.
And then we began to develop the overall correlations and some of the algorithms behind that to go through and break it down into major phases of a program. Everything that happens before you actually launch, in the pre-planning and formation stages, how important are those? I've run several large programs. I never knew how important some of those things were until mm-hmm. you find out another real professional if you don't do this.
But these metrics are all then based, what you're saying is they're all based on information that's been collected and not theorization.
Absolutely.
These are things that you've observed. This and when you have a significant quantity of them that you can collate that information, that's when you start to get numbers that mean something instead of theories. Well, this looks like to me this might not work.
Right.
Based on my two projects that I've run in my entire life, you're talking about a critical mass of information.
Yeah, and it's not a checklist.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what we see and Bill sees out there. Is most people have a checklist. Well, ours is more of a predictive model. So
mm-hmm.
we take the actual facts from the project, whether it be the schedule, the artifacts, the requirement documents, all the resources, we load that in, and we begin, and using our rapid simulation type model, and then begin doing some predictive analysis
mm-hmm.
and risk simulations, so that what comes out is based on the facts as we know it, on the overall program and the things that should be happening at this stage, is come up with a quantitative view that will say, here's what your probability is of meeting this schedule.
Mm-hmm.
Here's what your probability is of your cost distributions, you know, over this particular project, and here's what the impact could be on your benefits.
Mm-hmm.
And so now you have more of a fact-based discussions, and you know where the key points are that drive in this, as opposed to going through a checklist like it should be done this way because it's the best practices. Sometimes, I mean, while it's good and those represent good practices, what's the impact if you don't do it? Or to the degree to which they're done, based on the complexity of this program. And that's the thing. It's very much taking a look at the unique aspects of the complexity of the program.
Bill, continue on your track, though, talking about you have this analysis that you do, and then talk about how you proceed with somebody who comes to you in kind of a bad way. Once you've identified what the predictive elements are, what the possibilities are, how do you start to fix it and get things back together again?
Yeah, absolutely. So in this model that we're talking about, what we've got is it organizes those aspects into several different categories, right? And let's say, for example, governance might be a key issue, and the decision-making process within the project is a key issue. Within the model, we have elements that then can tell you, based on your score along a continuum, it's not just looking at do you do it, do you not do it, because looking at it, that binary doesn't tell you anything. It's, you know, how good are you along the scale, a 0 to 10 scale? Where are you in this continuum? And then based on where you are, gives you suggestions of mechanisms that you can put in place, actions that you can take in order to get that element on track. And then so if we look at that across, in this case, 120 or more elements, you can then develop a set of logic that says, okay, our issues are really revolving in and around the authority that the project team has to make decisions. And let's start really zeroing in on that as a key barrier ultimately to success. And let's put in place some remediation plans around how we can either give them more authority or less authority depending upon where they are in that continuum or where they need to be.
Yeah, and one point on there, which is really important, is that for all the programs we've looked at, there's never a shortfall for risks or problems. But we find continuously is that people react into the symptoms. And one of the things, as Bill was talking about, is that we approach it of looking at the interdependencies and looking at where the root cause is and look at the relationships between the root cause and the apparent proximate causes or the symptoms on that. So unless those root causes are really identified and understand how they reinforce each other, you take a holistic approach. That's why people will have a lot of corrective action. Check this, do this, do this. Well, guess what? You may be fixing a problem, a symptom, but you're not fundamentally getting a program back on track to achieve its objectives.
Just take a quick guess, Dave. Talk about the amount of times, a rough percentage, just pull one out of the sky based on your experience, on how many times people are trying to fix symptoms and how many times they're trying to fix root causes when they're trying to get something back together.
Well, in all the expert witness work I've done, it's been 100%.
Wow.
In all the work that we have done, and we've done this for years and years across a wide variety in our practices here at Ernst & Young, I would say it's the majority of the time. Majority of the time that people are looking at the symptoms and not the root cause. And so when we present that with the facts, then they can see that. And you see a holistic picture. It happens the vast majority, 80% of the time.
It's so difficult, I imagine, to step back from something that you're immersed in on a daily basis and say, what's really going on?
Absolutely.
What is really causing us to get where we are today? Try to take a break from that my hair is on fire mode that you're operating in. We're all rubbing our heads here. But that whole mentality of I got to stop this problem that's happening today because it's the one that's on my desk right now.
It's a human nature, right?
Yeah.
I mean, this is why you don't have people who are writing the code also test the code. It's not that they're trying to do anything bad. It's just that it's very difficult when you're immersed in a situation to have an objective view on those risks.
Yeah.
Right. And often what comes from that we see is that the view towards what is the end outcome is really underestimated, all right, overly optimistic. And that's, in part because it's hard to be objective when you're in that in the throes of the projects.
Yeah.
And so what we do is with these models is that we can then project out where are you going to end up from a time perspective, from a cost perspective, from a quality perspective. And what's that probability? Where is that 85% probability? Is that 4 months out? Is that 6 months out? And then you can quantify the impact of doing that, as well as quantify the impact of not taking those corrective action steps.
Yeah. I wish we had a lot more time to dig into this. We're just about out of time. This report that you sent over, is this available online?
It is not presently, but we'll make that available.
Okay,
online.
That'd be great.
Because that's just off the presses.
I'd love to link that up so that somebody who hears this can go and read this report called Rapid Project Assessment from Ernst & Young. Bill Colbert is a partner in the Assurance and Advisory Business Services Practice, and Dave Tomei, Executive Director in the Assurance and Advisory Business Services for Ernst & Young. Thank you very much, both of you gentlemen, for being on the program today. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
You're
Francis.
Welcome, Ralph.